to this afternoon's Assistant Principal webinar on keeping students safe every day. This is the first of this academic year's NAESP Quarterly Assistant Principals webinar. I'm Honor Feedy, a professional learning coordinator at NAESP, and I'll be providing support to our speakers this afternoon. I would encourage you all to use the chat box located on your webinar panel to write in your questions. We will entertain those at the end of the webinar, but please feel free to use the chat box to write in comments or questions. Our speakers today are Dr. Amy Klinger, Associate Professor of Educational Administration at Ashland University. She is also the Director of Programs for the Educators School Safety Network. With her is Amanda Klinger, a nationally recognized expert on cyberbullying, school safety, and the law. She is also the Director of Operations for the Educators School Safety Network. Thank you both, Amy and Amanda, for joining us this day, today and sharing your expertise with our audience.
Well, thank you for having us. Welcome, everyone. It's the beginning of a new school year, even though some of us may not feel like summer even happened. But we welcome you to the webinar and to a new school year. We want to kind of start out by giving you a little bit of our background and of our organization to kind of set the stage. We are the Educators School Safety Network. We are a national nonprofit. We work throughout the United States and Canada with a pretty simple mission in mind, and that is to put resources, training, and technical assistance in the hands of the folks who need it most, and that would be our first responders, our educators. So we come from an education perspective. My background is about 30 years of experience in public education, primarily as a school administrator at the elementary and secondary levels as a building principal. Clearly I taught, also worked a little bit in central office, and now I'm a professor at Ashland University teaching educational administration. So I help to move teachers to the dark side, to become administrators. So I have the distinct pleasure of working with my oldest daughter, and bringing her incredible capabilities to this work. So I'll let her, introduce herself.
Sure. I am Amanda Klinger. I'm the Director of Operations for the Educators School Safety Network. I am an attorney by training, which is sort of a different perspective for the way that we look at and address some of these issues. But I will try to behave today and not do too many obnoxious attorney things before we get too far here.
So we want to kind of just launch into our conversation today. And we kind of want to go sort of the proverbial inch deep and a mile wide to really talk about a variety of topics. Clearly, there are situational differences from one area to the next, or one school to the next, or one district to the next. So we want to kind of talk about some of the common themes and some of the common issues that we see in our work throughout the United States. And I think even more significantly, it's really important for us to be more proactive as opposed to reactive. So we're also going to talk about some of the emerging trends and some of the emerging issues that we see as we've been doing this work over the years. So we want to kind of ask you to reflect a little bit as we move through on how these things might be true in your school, what we could do about them, because we always like to do more than just admire the problem. We always like to make sure that we include some tips and strategies as well. So with that being said, Amanda, you want to start some of the introductory stuff?
Sure. So I think we want to kind of start by talking a little bit about, you know, why haven't we solved this problem of school safety? You know, we've been dealing with violence in American public schools since their inception. You know, last school year was the 20th anniversary of Columbine. And so the question is, you know, why are we still dealing with this? Why haven't we solved this problem of school safety? And I think one of the big reasons is that schools have a tendency to think erroneously that it won't happen here. And the reason that people think it won't happen here is because they tend to have this narrow view of school safety as only active shooter response. And when we have falsely equated school safety with active shooter response, we're missing out on a lot of the other types of hazards that schools might face. So you deal with schools that have had catastrophic weather events, schools that deal with bus accidents and incidents with buses, or schools that are dealing with some other type of lower level violent or other incident that might necessitate a law enforcement response. So the solution here is we need to shift our thinking. It will happen here because we're talking broadly about school crisis events. So the solution is that every school has to improve. Continuous education or continuous improvement is baked into the culture of education. That is sort of the bread and butter of education, is that we are continuously improving. We're continuously improving our practices, our procedures, our instruction, our lesson plans, and every school has to be able to improve when we're talking about the work of school safety. Second problem we've identified is that a lot of this work oftentimes is done in isolation. So we have policymakers, law enforcement, emergency services folks, mental health folks, and school folks. Everybody's doing the work of school safety, but they tend to be doing it, I'd like to say idiomatically, in silos. But we were in Iowa not that long ago, and we were told in no uncertain terms that these are not silos. These are grain bins. So you'll have to bear
any folks here from Iowa, we understand these aren't silos.
Yeah, we realize how serious it is. But doing that work in silos causes a number of problems, and it typically looks like people talking at educators. So we have policymakers or first responders talking at teachers and saying, this is what we ought to do, and leaving out the voice and the expertise of educators who are on the front lines of all of these concerns. You know, law enforcement has an important role to play, especially when we're talking about school violence. And we love when we work with districts that have really good working relationships with their local law enforcement. And that's really, really critical. But the solution to school safety problem is educators. And that's because school safety is an educational issue that happens to involve safety and security. It is not a law enforcement issue that happens to take place in our schools. And unfortunately, that is, I think, often how this is framed, that this is a law enforcement issue. Law enforcement will come in and they will solve this problem. And educators have largely abdicated a lot of this responsibility. And we cannot take our traditional modalities of policing and just place them on top of the school. We are running schools, not prisons. And so we can work with law enforcement, and that's an important partner, but educators need to be the loudest voice in this work. I apologize. I don't know if you can hear my dog or in the background or not, but that's happening. Sorry. The third problem that we see is that committing to doing this work isn't enough. So often we see schools struggle with a lack of funding, a lack of professional development time. You all as school leaders know we hardly have enough professional development time to do the thing, you know, that we went into education for, let alone to carve out time to do some of this difficult and nuanced work. We see schools that often struggle with a checklist mentality, which is that, you know, the state legislators have said, these are the things that you must do. You must do X number of drills. You must do this type of training. And it doesn't leave a lot of room for schools to be able to look critically at what their needs are and to be strategic. And so they are so bogged down with requirements, whether they're good requirements or not, and that people check off those requirements and then say, okay, well, we've done what was prescribed to us, and therefore we should be safe. We see school districts who are often overwhelmed by the options that do exist. You know, school security is a $1 billion booming industry, and school leaders get a lot of marketing messages about school security interventions. There's not a ton of data on whether those are effective or not. We're going to talk about that a little bit later in this webinar, but that's a really overwhelming prospect for school leaders. So the solution here, we need to move beyond buying school safety stuff, and we're going to talk about that more in a moment. We need to have training for pre-service teachers and pre-service administrators. I think it's unconscionable that we send people into the field without 1 minute of required training or coursework in the thing that could end their lives or end their careers or end the lives of the children in their care. So that's something that we need to think about if we want to have systemic change. We need to be able to connect people with the great resources that do exist. That's part of the work that we do as a nonprofit, try to be able to connect people with the stuff that is out there that is evidence-based. Fourth problem, and this is the last problem, I promise, we have a training that we tend to see that's very reactionary. So after Parkland, everybody went out and got more school shooting training, active shooter response training, even though that was probably the only school safety training that they had had all school year. So it's react, react, react. We see training that is only from a law enforcement or security orientation. And we see that, you know, unfortunately, you know, we're asking law enforcement to come in and solve this problem for us. And we'll talk a little bit more about some of the unintended consequences of having training that is only from a law enforcement or security orientation. And then we see training that's only for administrators. It's sort of this trickle-down economics theory of training, that you come and you'll get training in this, and then you can go back and answer all the questions of your faculty and your staff and your colleagues. And that's an unfair position. I think it's an unfair position to put law enforcement in to have to solve these problems, I think it's unfair to say to administrators, become an expert in this, solve all these problems for your folks. So the solution here, we need to have ongoing high quality training. We need to be able to have training that's developmentally appropriate and based in evidence. And then most importantly, coming from a comprehensive all hazards approach. And we're going to expand on all of these things throughout the hour today, but that's just kind of a good framework to think about some of these things.
And I know those things seem really simplistic. Well, of course, but from the work that we do, and probably if you reflect within your district as well, those things aren't always happening. So it's really important that we do really look at, are we doing training that's developmentally appropriate? Are we looking at things other than active shooter? And we'll expand on that a little bit. So we want to spend just a quick moment talking a little bit about what we know to be true. I mean, there's a unique situation with schools. You know, everyone went to school, so everyone thinks they know everything about schools. So if you went down to your grocery store and you asked 10 people, you know, what's happening in schools with safety or with violence, you would get 10 different answers, and they wouldn't necessarily be accurate. So we need to get beyond sort of our perceptions or what we see reported in the media and really look at what is happening in terms of school safety. So we have been doing an analysis of that every school year for the past 3 or 4 years. And the most recent report for the 18-19 school year is actually going to be released in about a week or so. But I want to just show you a little bit to kind of set the stage for as we come out of one school year and head into the other. So this is comparing the 16-17 school year with the 17-18 school year. And as you can see, we saw a pretty significant increase. And this is looking purely at the number of threats. So this is someone saying that they're going to do something or somehow making a threat against the school. And we had a 62% increase just from 1 year to the next. And we've seen that increase over time. When we look at a couple of successive falls, we can see that increase as it goes from 9% to 63%. Now let's look at that from two sides of that coin. First of all, there's an increase in the number of threats that are actually occurring, but there's also something that we need to consider, which is if we have an increase in the number of threats, some of that is also, I think, can be attributed to people's awareness that maybe they're reporting things that they weren't reporting before. But the takeaway here is that we can't just think of it as, well, it's just a threat, so it's not a big deal. If we look back at this incredible increase and the significant number of threats that occur in schools, there is a cost to us. There's a cost to our kids. There's loss of instructional time. There's consumption of resources of police and fire. We're not doing this other thing of educating kids because we're over here trying to respond to a bomb threat. There's a lot of anxiety and fear on the parts of parents and students and staff. There's also the asset of trust and reputation of what's happening if the school isn't a safe place. And when we don't respond appropriately to threats because we haven't trained or planned to do that, oftentimes that creates even more threats because people are going to do what works. If a threat causes chaos and panic, that's way more interesting and exciting than second period algebra. So it's probably going to happen again. So we need to focus some of our efforts in school safety on responding to, preventing, and dealing with threats, not just looking at actual incidents. So that's one of the first takeaways. The second one now is looking here at actual incidents. So these are incidents of violence where something occurred that required a response. Maybe a gun was found or a shooting, or there was a non-custodial parent or a false report of an active shooter or a plot that was thwarted where something actually occurred. And if you look at the 16-17 school year compared to the 17-18 school year, you see that 113% increase that you see on your screen. And that was before Parkland. So when we talk about Parkland occurring in February of 2018, that was really a symptom, not the disease, because that increase of 118% was already happening as we move through all of these time periods from 16, 17, 18. So it's really important for us to have sort of a duality in looking at this problem, both incidents and threats, because they both have a cost. One of the things that we found, and we're seeing this in the research that's going to be coming out in a couple of weeks, is the role of social media. And clearly, at one point, it was right around 40%. By the time it's all said and done for this past school year, it's going to be about half of all threats come from social media. And again, this is not a big surprise, but we have to, again, think about the cost of that. So we may be dealing with the threat that's occurring in the school, but there's all this other stuff happening out there in social media. So if I make a threat in a classroom, you know, this class makes me feel like killing people, which was one that actually was dealt with, you know, 22 people hear it. I put on Facebook, watch out, MHS, you're the next school to be targeted, or you're, I'm coming for you, which again happened right after Parkland. And that was shared 280,000 times and impacted 43 different high schools with the acronym MHS in 23 different states over a period of about 36 hours. So we cannot discount the role of social media in terms of threats, but the answer is not necessarily to implement a surveillance data where we're paying companies incredible amounts of money to surveil our students' social media, because that's not overly effective as well. But we certainly have to acknowledge that there is a role and a problem in the use of technology and social media as part of our school safety planning. Bomb incidents we pulled out to specifically talk to you about a little bit as well. 22% of all incidents in the 17-18 school year were bomb related. And we don't necessarily in schools often think of that. This is looking at in 17-18, one detonation, four explosive devices found and 22 suspicious items. And I can tell you in 16-17 and in 18-19, the number of detonations was closer to between 4 and 6. Detonations. Now, these were not catastrophic detonations, but they were where someone brought an explosive device in one case in St. Louis, put it up against the door of an elementary school and blew up the door. Now, was it a mass casualty event? No. Was it frightening? Was there the potential for injuries? Was it disruptive? You know, clearly all of those things are the case. And one of the concerns that I have is that we are not in schools typically prepared to respond to bomb incidents because we've spent so much time looking at active shooter events. And we know, you know, this past April was the 20th anniversary of Columbine. We know that Columbine was supposed to be a bombing event. And so our potential perpetrators are well aware of that. And we've seen a pretty significant uptick, not only in the number of bomb threats, but also in the number of bomb-related incidents, and also a pretty significant increase in the number of thwarted plots where someone had bomb-making materials or had a plan that involved both weapons and bombs as part of it. So you may want to go back and have some conversations in your district about, are we even planning or talking about bomb incidents other than an isolated bomb threat? Are we really talking about, and do we have a plan and training that involves identifying suspicious items and so on? And one of the things that we do in schools that really leaves us open to this is that we have stuff everywhere. It would be very difficult in many, many schools to identify a suspicious item because there's backpacks and lacrosse bags and lunch boxes and all kinds of things all over the place, and in every storage room and closet, it's stuffed to the gills with things. So it's oftentimes very difficult for us to identify some of those potentially dangerous items. So those are some things that we need to kind of take a look at as well.
So I think now we'll kind of shift the focus a little bit and talk about this distinction between school security or school safety. And we see a lot of schools that are undertaking a school security approach, or they're doing a lot of security interventions. And it comes down to this fundamental question: is in the way that we're approaching school safety, are we empowering folks or are we intimidating folks? And you know, there is a cost to having this intimidating security type approach to school safety. I don't know how many of you are familiar with this. This happened back in March in Indiana, where they had, as part of an active shooter training, where they had teachers who, as part of the training, were shot mock execution style with airsoft guns. And I don't totally know what the purpose was supposed to be, but we know that the net effect was that those folks were very intimidated. You know, in 2019, I don't think that there's really much value in teaching teachers that there's the potential for violence in our schools. I think people are pretty well aware of that. And so we
are pretty anxious about it. I equate it to if you're going to take a self-defense course, and we began the self-defense course by beating the living daylights out of you just to prove that you need a self-defense course. I'm not sure that we need to scare teachers into believing that there's a potential for violence in schools because they are already aware of that.
And I think we need to examine what is the impact of this type of training that is only from a law enforcement orientation, and sometimes is very, very intimidating, and we don't have any data to know whether having that type of training, like how you would train law enforcement, security, military folks, if that's effective. We do know that there is definitely a large increase in anxiety and fear and trauma, and there's lots and lots of anecdotal evidence supporting people talking about how traumatized they were by training of this. This type. And then the other thing that we see a lot of is the use of students and teachers as props in a training that's actually for law enforcement. So they're firing blanks so that we can hear what it sounds like in the school. We have people who are dressed up as victims so that we can train how we would triage. And there's a cost to all of those.
And that's not to say that that training is not appropriate in a tactical sense for law enforcement. But if that's the only training that our students and teachers are getting, is the idea of you are a helpless victim and there's nothing that you can do, that's really potentially damaging. And part of the issue that at hand is the second bulleted point here of we're seeing a very alarming trend of staff people saying, I'm out. I won't participate. If all we're going to do is be traumatized and pretend that there is a shooter, I'm not participating. And that's an even more dangerous situation to have this big gap between folks that have been trained and those that have not or have refused to.
So the question then is, what do we do about it? I think we need to make sure that we're really specific that the training that we do is professional development. We're really specific about that language of school safety, professional development, because it's coming from an education orientation. Everything that we're doing in the work of school safety has to serve our central mission, which is educating kids. We also need to make sure that we're talking about how do we decentralize authority, so that we don't have this very centralized top-down approach, but that we're able to work collaboratively as professional colleagues, which is the way that we do everything else in education, and we have sort of dismissed that paradigm when we talk about school safety.
And that's particularly alarming when we work in schools where there may be one person, you know, that's very highly trained, the administrator or the assistant superintendent in charge of safety or the buildings guy. But when you get down to the level of the classroom and the building where those are the real first responders, there is no training. They have not been trained or empowered. And their belief is that they're going to sit around and wait for someone to tell them what to do. And if we think about that in terms of a response to anything, active shooter, a fire, a medical emergency, pick something, it's incredibly dangerous to have people standing around wasting precious response time, waiting for someone to tell them what to do because they themselves have not been trained and empowered to make the critical decisions that need to happen in the instant of that event. And so that's a very troubling trend for us.
Another thing that we talk about in some of these security orientations versus a safety orientation is what is the cost of some of the measures that we've adopted that are truly surveillance measures? What are the impact of these types of things that tend to treat students like inmates? So we're doing surveillance, we're doing increased searches, this increased law enforcement presence. Recently, the city of New York was talking about expanding their security capabilities with additional cameras, additional metal detectors, and there was a protest from students in New York. They were chanting things like counselors, not cops, supports, not surveillance. And it's very difficult for us to truly understand what are the long-term impacts of the ways the things that we have done in the name of school safety, and we don't know where some of the unintended consequences. We do have some research about what's happening in this realm. We saw that in 2016, 94% of high schools had cameras to monitor students, and that this was double the amount of high schools that had cameras just 10 years before. A 2017 study found that students reported lower perceptions of safety when there were more cameras inside the school. So it's not that the cameras make the students feel safer. They're actually reporting an inverse correlation between cameras inside the school and feelings of safety. It made the students feel like they were being viewed as potential perpetrators who needed surveillance. The students, however, associated cameras outside the school with safety and security and higher levels of feeling secure. So there is, you know, some data to support that there are unintended consequences to some of the surveillance that we're undertaking. You want to talk anything else about that?
Yeah, I think it's really important for us to really look at the dilemmas that schools are facing here. So, you know, we can have conversations about surveillance and these sort of issues, and we can say, well, cameras do great things. And we're not saying that you can't ever, that we should never use technology, but we have to use it intentionally. And we also have to closely examine the unintended consequences of many of the initiatives that we're doing. And we often find schools in a position where, and this is anything from discussions of arming teachers, which becomes a gun control debate, which it shouldn't be, discussions of technology use and surveillance and all these things, when in reality, we need to start with the place that what we can all agree on. No one wants kids dying in schools. And then we build from there. But we have to look at both sides of those issues. We can't just say we're going to do this 1,000% and never think about what might be the unintended consequences of that. And so I think it's really important for us as educators to be intentional and apolitical and really looking at what's this really doing or not doing for kids? What's the cause or the rationale, the unintended consequence? And all of those things need to be on the table for discussion instead of us making dichotomous choices and saying, this is what we're doing and we're never talking about anything else. So I think that professional dialogue needs to rise above the manipulation of politics and the media and all these other things, and really have a professional dialogue about what's good for kids, what makes sense, and how do we serve these dual purposes of running a school, not a prison, but also keeping kids safe. So that middle ground is where we really are struggling to get to.
Sure. And when we're talking about increased surveillance security, what we're trying to accomplish is to get information, to understand what's going on so that we can work to prevent violence of all sorts in our schools. And so if we know that additional surveillance measures, whether that's cameras or whether it's monitoring of social media, et cetera, there's unintended negative consequences of those things. But what we do know is that when we build a relationship-based culture so that we are eliciting disclosures from students, the unintended consequences of that is positive. So I think it's important for us to focus on this sort of a method of getting disclosures from students, because it helps us get the information that we need, and also it has a positive impact. Do you want to talk about disclosures a little bit?
Yeah, I think it's really important for you to note and for us to acknowledge that at this moment in a school, in your school, there are kids that know something you should know, and you're probably not being told what that thing is. We can go back and give you incredible examples of all of these horrific events that happened, and then come to find out 10 or 15 or 20 different people knew this was happening and they didn't tell, and et cetera, et cetera. And I'm not telling you what to write down today, but if I would, I would tell you to write down this discussion of what are some of the obstacles to student disclosures that exist in your school. So let's talk about that for a minute. You know, when we talk about why kids know something and don't tell us, we know the shooter in Arapahoe in Centennial, Colorado showed 9 different people the weapon he was going to use. He had a countdown in his agenda book. He told all kinds of people. And then we say, well, how do we not see this? And I think that's what was so jarring and infuriating about Parkland, was the number of warning signs that were missed. So when we talk about obstacles to student disclosure, we need to first start with, why don't kids tell us what they know? And you could generate all kinds of examples and reasons, you know, that we don't rat on our friends, I'm afraid of retaliation, all those sorts of things. But one of the most significant reasons kids don't disclose is they don't think we're going to do anything about it, because we've not had discussions about it and we've not closely examined what the obstacles are. So I'm going to do a 30-second little quick example for you.
And before you do that, I know what example you're going to use. I think it's important for everybody to remember that when we're talking about getting information, getting disclosures from students, we are not just talking about someone who's plotting a shooting event or someone who has a weapon. We're talking about a student who is in a dating relationship that is potentially to be violent, someone who is maybe going to bring vodka in their water bottle, someone who's engaging in some type of risk-taking behavior, even if it's a low level of violence against themselves or others. So keep in mind that we're trying to look for all of this information where we can provide a broad range of supports and interventions. So
that's a great point. We can't always default to, oh, you're talking about active shooter. Oh, you're talking about the next shooter. No, we're talking about kids at risk for violence against themselves or others. So if we look at a quick 30-second example, if I'm a kid on a bus, I see my seatmate's backpack is open and I think he has a knife in it and I'm not sure. So what would you want me to do? Well, all of you would say, well, you need to tell an adult. Okay, well, I'm going to tell the bus driver. So when I'm ready to get off the bus, I now have to rat out my friend in front of him. I'm not going to do that. The bus driver is going to go, come on, go, go, go. I got my next route. Okay, well, maybe you want me to stop in the office and tell them. So I'm in the office there in the morning where it's total chaos, and I'm probably just going to get yelled at of, get to class, what are you doing? Well, maybe I can make an appointment with the counselor, or maybe I can catch someone in the hallway. Those are all obstacles to disclosure, and they're probably fairly obvious ones. But the ones that I'm also concerned about are the obstacles to disclosure where you tell me as a kid, just go tell your teacher. And so I encounter someone supervising in the hallway or my teacher standing outside the door. And what are they doing? Most likely they're with another adult. Two adults together is a very significant obstacle to student disclosure, because I'm not going to interrupt two adults to rat out my friend or to tell them something that I'm not sure really even happened. And so the more obstacles there are, the more I have convinced myself, I really didn't see that. And it's probably not that big of a deal. And maybe somebody else will tell. And all the way down to the most innocuous obstacle is I'm standing there on my phone. I am not accessible to kids. And so we have to acknowledge that unwittingly, we have created obstacles to disclosure where we have made ourselves unavailable to kids. We may be there physically with the pulse standing in that place, but we aren't necessarily accessible to kids because we're talking to someone else, we're checking our email, we're on our phone. And so we have to take a critical look. I challenge you to go into your school and walk around and think like that kid that we were just talking about and see how long or how difficult it would be for me to be able to disclose that thing. And I know everybody says, oh, we have a statewide tip line, and those tip lines or your local tip lines are great. But when I have a concern about Nicole, my friend who seems withdrawn and I don't know what's up, I'm not going to call your tip line. But I may disclose and have a conversation with my math teacher who I know and trust, who has talked to us about, you need to let me know, and here's how I'm available to you, and all those different things to establish that relationship. So I challenge you to go back and have a few uncomfortable sort of self-assessment about how would kids in our school be able to disclose the things that we know are occurring in our school.
And there's a couple things I want to add to that briefly, is to think of how different does that feel as a student. To have a concern and I'm not really sure, and I get I get shoved out of the office, I get shooed out of the bus, I get shooed into class, and the teachers are talking to each other and they're on their phone and no one seems super engaged with me, and the implicit, suggestion is, call the statewide tip line. Think of how different that feels, that feeling of being surveilled or ignored or whatever, versus I know that my teachers care about this, and they have demonstrated and they've told us that they have a commitment to us and to providing supports and interventions, and think of how different that feels. Another thing to consider is the official messaging that we've told to students around this issue is only one thing. The only thing that we ever say to students is stop tattling. And I realize that we do that so that we can have elementary school.
Without the teachers going insane, yeah.
But we have to move past that notion. We tell adults, if you see something, say something. So we have to start giving official messaging from students, from teachers to students, that if there's a concern, you can tell us. There might be a discipline consequence, but the reason that you're telling us is so that we can help. We can help your friends. We can provide supports and interventions. We can stop a bad thing from happening. And so we have to start shifting that a little bit. Another thing that we talk about a lot when we're talking about increasing disclosures is strategic supervision. So instead of the change of classes means I stand in front of my door and I supervise the 18-inch semicircle in front of my door, it means that I am being strategic in my supervision. So where are the students? Where am I needed? Not where is it convenient for me as an adult to supervise, but where am I needed? And so we always recommend that change of class looks like me as a teacher standing in the middle of the hallway and students going by on either side. If I have a planning period, it means I can be moving around. I can be in different places. And it's not just supervising that I'm watching kids, but I'm accessible to students. We were doing a vulnerability assessment once, and we saw three students come around a corner, and one was sort of like a puny eighth grader and two bigger kids, and something was going to happen. I don't know if it was going to be a fight or a harassment type situation, but that littler student saw us because we were visible and accessible to that student, and they came up to us and was like, oh, hey, what are you doing? Simply being accessible as a visible and a sight line has a lot of value for students.
And I think the, you know, when we do these vulnerability assessments, that's one of the biggest things that we see that is a really significant risk factor is there just is not adequate supervision. You have, you know, 300 kids in the vestibule and one teacher that is not adequate supervision. And when we go back and look at a lot of the lower level incidents that occur where there's injuries or other issues, in many, many cases, it's because there was not adequate supervision and the supervision wasn't strategically placed where we need it. Before school and after school are the biggest vulnerabilities where we just don't have enough folks where they need to be able to prevent many of the things that happen. And we haven't really said this explicitly, but I think it bears, I guess we need to. You know, clearly we talk about active shooter and we can see the tragedy and the horrific, unspeakable tragedy that occurs when we have a school shooting. But we also have to acknowledge that if we have a child who gets killed in the parking lot of our school because we didn't have adequate supervision at dismissal, that's a tragedy too. So a child that dies of anaphylactic shock because we weren't prepared medically to deal with that, that's a tragedy as well. So while clearly we acknowledge the horrific nature of school shootings, we also have to acknowledge that the death of a student in our school, whether it's suicide or medical or accidental or whatever it might be, those are equally horrific tragedies. And we have to be equally prepared and plan to respond to those in the same fashion.
So I would challenge you when we're talking about strategic supervision and being accessible to students to sort of do that thought experiment of at this change of classes or during the middle of fourth period, if I was a student, how many steps would I need to take to get support from an adult? So if I had a nosebleed, how long would it take me to be able to find a person? And that might be another uncomfortable self-assessment of maybe it's really, really difficult to find an adult to get support. The other thing we want to talk about is what about all of the school safety concerns we have ignored while we're so busy doing active shooter drills? This is in the whole time that we've been doing this work, there is this incredible overemphasis on active shooter response. All of the training is about active shooter response. All of the resources about active shooter response. All the media attention, parent concern, it's all about active shooter response. I said earlier, school safety isn't just about active shooter response, but our school safety training and drills almost always are. So what does the research say about this? Is it well-founded for us to have put all of our eggs in the basket of this one type of concern? We have a study from 2010 indicating that the odds that a K-12 student will be shot and killed in a school are roughly 1 in 614 million. And again, that one is unacceptable, and it's a tragedy that we do need to work to prevent, and we do need to make sure that we have the capability to respond to. But I can tell you, I don't have data on it, unfortunately, but I can tell you that the odds of a student falling down the stairs and breaking their leg, much higher than 1 in 614 million. The odds of a student being bullied, harassed, someone propositioning them for drugs or some other type of risk or hazard, the odds are much more likely than 1 in 614 million. So we have to start putting this atypical event in proper perspective.
In the 17-18 school year, the number of suicides that occurred on campus in schools doubled from the year before. Again, it wasn't a highly significant number, but it was a significant number that it doubled from one year to the next. So there is a cost to us having this laser focus in potentially the wrong direction.
We have data from a 2018 study looking at from 1992 to 2015, fewer than 3% of child murders occurred at school. And I think this speaks to the notion that we have unnecessarily, as schools, owned the problem of school safety. Because we're only doing...
Well, the problem of active shooter.
The problem of active shooter, that we're saying that because we're doing all of these drills that are active shooter response drills, what we're sort of, the subtext of what we're saying to students and to parents is, this is a fundamentally unsafe place. We're doing all of these scary drills and trainings because this is an unsafe place, as opposed to, I'm teaching you safety skills. If we teach our littlest little students to stop, drop, and roll in the event of a fire, that's a safety skill because we framed it as a skill, and we need to make sure that we're being really strategic about the way that we approach some of these as well. So what we should do about it, we need to make sure that we have a training that is comprehensive and from an all hazards approach. And we need to fold our school safety work into part of our daily operating procedures. So instead of we had one active shooter training at the beginning of the school year and then we move on and just do our normal academic work, part of what we're doing all the time in all of our procedures and all of our policies and all the decisions we make is that we have an undercurrent of safety. And one recommendation that we make to schools is that every meeting that you have has a school safety agenda item. And that doesn't mean you need to speak about school safety for 45 minutes, but we have carved out that little tiny slice of time to talk about school safety. And it also has the psychological effect of reminding us school safety is something that we need to be concerned with every day, not just at the very beginning of the school year.
And I think, let me add one thing to that. I also think it's really important that we're not saying that you need to be hypervigilant, that your teachers need to walk around in a state of panic because they're so concerned about school safety in every moment. It's instead something Amanda uses a great analogy of, sort of an app running in the background, that we always have an eye on what is it that we do every day, that we do in our classrooms, that we do in our procedures, and how does that work into all hazards, sort of an all hazards approach to safety. And I think it's really important that we diversify beyond just we did an active shooter lockdown and that's the only thing we ever need to concern ourselves with.
And one, you know, thing that we talk about that's a daily operating procedure that has a lot of impact beyond just preventing active shooters is visitor engagement. And so visitor engagement is the policy and the procedure that everyone who collects a paycheck from this institution, from this school district, will engage with visitors. And we're really specific about the language of engagement because we're not saying that you should confront people like, hey, who are you? It can be a very welcoming, it can be part of the school climate and culture that we engage with visitors. So, good morning, how can I help you? And I see that you're here in the computer server room. Let's get you to the place where you need to be. I noticed that you haven't checked in. We have visitors sign in, and that's a way that we keep our school community safe. Let's make sure that we get you properly signed in. It doesn't need to be combative. It doesn't need to be confrontational. But for folks who are there with ill intent, whether that's to steal iPhones or take a student that they don't have custody of, it's a real problem when the people who work there keep trying to help them, trying to put them in the right direction, trying to make sure that they're signed in properly. And for folks who are there with good intent, who are maybe there to enroll a new student or to tour the school or help fix the copy machine, you help them get to the place where they need to be. Do you want to talk anything else about visitor engagement?
Yeah, we talked a few minutes ago about when we do vulnerability assessments. Virtually every school we have done, from a very affluent school to a very rural school with very few resources, almost every school we've done a vulnerability assessment and has several common elements, which I will go out on a limb and say may very well be issues in your school as well. One of them I already alluded to, the lack of supervision, not having enough supervision. And the other is almost always visitor engagement, where we have people coming in and no one is talking to them. No one is figuring out who that person is. We're all just kind of assuming it's somebody else and there's somebody else is going to take care of it. And then the third thing is oftentimes access control. And the common theme that these all have, and I don't have this picture, but I love to tell this story. The common theme that they all have is we took a picture one time at a school and it was a fire door officially, and it said officially fire door. And then it had a piece of paper, handwritten, fire door, do not prop open. And it was propped open with a fire extinguisher. So as a former English teacher, I appreciate the irony of that. But I think it's really a great example for administrators to really say, what kind of a staff do you have? Do you have a staff that's going to walk by that and go, not my problem, I don't do anything with safety, the principal or someone else better take care of this because it's not my deal? Or do you have a staff that has been empowered to say, you know what, this is a problem and I need to take care of it? That's what you have in visitor engagement. When you have someone who sees someone suspicious and goes, well, not my job, I hope someone else talks to them. Or this is an issue that I need to take care of. I have a responsibility. I'm empowered to take care of this. I'm empowered to make decisions. And so I think that's a really important litmus test for staffs and where we need to be moving to.
A big thing that supports the work of visitor engagement is if we are in a school district where we have said you as faculty and staff are supposed to wear ID badges. And we see, you know, administrators who go around and around. And now to be clear, we're not talking about ID badges for students, which is a separate issue. And I don't think has quite the same value as having ID badges for staff. But having ID badges for faculty and staff sets us up for success because any adult who is not wearing an ID badge of the school presumably should have some sort of a visitor badge and we should be engaging with them. So that sets us up for success with visitor engagement. The other concern that we have with ID badges, it's a good example of the difference between complying with the policy or engaging with the policy. And we've seen schools where the administrators have said, wear ID badges. That's the policy. Wear them. But they've never explained to folks the rationale. We wear ID badges so that it makes visitor engagement easier. We wear ID badges so that students know who's a safe person. So a little kindergartner knows my kindergarten teacher is a safe person, but also the third grade teacher that has the lanyard and the badge of my school, who maybe I don't know very well, but they are a safe person. So in an emergency, I know that I go with a safe person because they have the ID badge. Also, it's helpful for first responders who roll up to an event and they have sometimes a hard time knowing who is a nosy parent, who is a vaguely professional looking high school student, and who's a member of the faculty and staff here. So if I've explained the reasoning and the rationale of why do we wear ID badges, that's something that as a community of professional educators, we can say, you know what? That's important. That's going to be a norm. That's going to be an expectation. That's something that we as professionals have decided is important and we're going to do it. That's the difference between complying with the directive and engaging with the policy because we understand why that is. And as you might guess, you'll have incredible more success with school safety initiatives when folks are engaging with them and saying, this is part of the way we want to do things here. We're going to engage with visitors. We're going to wear our ID badges. We're going to make sure that doors are not propped open because we understand why it's important. It's what's best for kids and what's best for safety. And even if it's inconvenient for me as the adult, I understand the rationale and I'm willing to engage with that policy.
And I think that's a good place to take a 10-second time out. Again, I'm not telling you to write things down, but if I were, I would say we also need to take a critical look at that discrepancy that Amanda just alluded to between here's what we have written down as our policy and our board adopted procedures, and then here's what we really do. When we have a discrepancy like that, we have incredible liability, and I'll let the attorney speak to that, but we also have created a situation where people don't really know for sure what we're doing because we say that we're doing this, but we're not really doing that. We're doing this thing over here. So that discrepancy between what's written down and formalized and what we really do is a big problem in many of these initiatives, in school safety in particular.
So really briefly, I want to kind of finish up here talking about this notion of stop buying school safety stuff. So we saw the recently was passed, the Stop Violence Act was backed by the Partner Alliance for Safer Schools and the Secure Schools Alliance. Okay, great. Well, when you dig into those organizations are industry trade groups. They are security systems. They are security companies who have formed these lobbying agencies that are backing this research, that are backing these legislation that's calling for this incredible amount of expenditure on school security interventions. In 2017, security equipment and services generated a revenue of $2.7 billion in the education sector alone. So this is a huge, huge revenue stream for folks who are taking the same type of security interventions that you have at courthouses and hospitals and inserting them into our schools. And we talked a little bit about this earlier, some of the unintended consequences. And I would challenge you to think, you know, if you walk through a metal detector while you're heading to a sporting event, you as a participant, you as a fan walking through the metal detector doesn't impact the outcome of the game. But we know, and there's data to support, that forcing students to walk through metal detectors before their school day has a suppressing effect on academic achievement. And so we have to think of, are we spending our money wisely, and are we spending it on things that have these unintended negative consequences on academic achievement? The RAND Policy Institute did research looking at school security interventions, both hardware and software, and their big finding, this huge report, their big finding was that schools need better information on what works. Schools are spending a lot of money on these things that we don't know how effective they are for their intended purposes, and then we also don't know what are the unintended consequences of interventions like this.
And that takes us back to our discussion of the dilemmas that schools face. So a school, you know, has parents pounding on the table going, make the school safe, make the school safe. And they want to be able to hold something up and say, look, here's this thing we bought. This is this thing that we did, which is a tangible item, this app or this metal detector or this whatever it might be. But yet what they purchased oftentimes is security theater. It looks like something that is going to keep people safe, but there is no evidence to support that it really does. The people haven't been adequately trained in what to do with it. And so we have this thing that we have spent a lot of money on that oftentimes is typically just for one event, the most statistically unlikely event of an active shooter. but yet we have not invested in our people. We've invested in stuff. And so we get the question a lot of how do we do both of those things? And I think it's really important that we look at how we're spending the resources of time and money and personnel. And we look at those and say, we should be spending equal amounts on prevention as we are on response. Right now, many schools are spending 100% of everything on response to an active shooter, and that's it. We should be spending equal amounts on prevention and response. We should be spending equal amounts. So for every dollar we spend on a thing, a shiny thing, we should be spending a dollar investing in people, in the training of staff and students and teachers and parents, and that sort of training that empowers those folks to know what to do far beyond an active shooter event. And so it's really, it only makes sense from a dollar and cents perspective, as well as from an effectiveness perspective, that yes, we prepare for an active shooter, but we also prepare for all of these other things that we know are much more statistically likely to occur. And that we invest not only in physical, tangible things, but we invest in our folks. We invest in the building the capacity of the people who are going to be responding to this event. That imbalance right now is making our schools much less safe. And that's much of the reason why we see this continual increase in threats and violence and incidents and all these other things that are happening, because we are not really looking at this issue holistically. We're just trying to throw money at one particular thing, and all that it's doing is making some companies much richer, but it's not making our schools any safer.
So the question is, where do we go from here? I know that we sort of talked about a lot of different things in a pretty short period of time. Hopefully that there were some concrete takeaways of things that you can go back and start to think about critically with your colleagues and with your staffs, because there is so much that we can do. And our goal in all of this work and in all of our professional development is not that we think, oh, well, I just hope nothing bad happens this school year. There is a lot of things that we can do to prevent violence, to prevent accidents, and to make sure that we are having the correct policies and procedures in place to be able to communicate effectively and to be paying attention to these different sort of things. Before we answer questions, I did want to briefly show, this was
our shameless promotion aspect.
Yeah, this is our book that we published last fall. And we were really specific about coming from an all hazards orientation. So there is a chapter about active shooter response, but there's only one chapter about that. And it is for practitioners. And so it is a kind of a no nonsense look at, we don't know what we don't know. And so have you considered these things, and what can we do to improve the level of preparedness in our schools? This is all of our contact information. If you have any questions, you can always reach out to us directly, either via email or on social media. And so please don't hesitate to reach out with any questions or anything else that we can do to help.
And as we mentioned at the beginning, we are a nonprofit with a very specific mission of trying to put free resources in your hands. So I encourage you to go to our website, download whatever you need, follow us on Facebook and Twitter, because there's only so many hours in the day and it's difficult to stay current in these issues. And so we want to support the work that you're doing. We want to give you the resources necessary to be able to do this critical and important work. We can't just sit here and harp about it in a webinar. We also have to be able to put our money where our mouth is and provide you with that assistance. So I encourage you to connect with us in all those different ways so that we can help you with this critical work.
Wonderful. Thank you both. This has been a great webinar. For those of you that are still on, please write in any questions that you might have. In the meantime, I have a question about what your advice would be for new principals who maybe are kind of new to this in terms of prevention. Are there specific steps that you would recommend that they take now that we're in a new year?
Absolutely. As a new administrator, you need to familiarize yourself with the existing policies and procedures. That's clearly a big one. But I think what you also have to always have in the back of your head, you know, and we say this all the time, parents will forgive you if your test scores fall or if the chicken nuggets weren't ready on time, but parents will never forgive you if something happens to their kids in your school. So safety needs to move to the very top of your list. It's not the only thing that you do, but certainly familiarizing yourself with the existing plans, being open-minded and looking around and critically at what's happening talking with your staff about these are the important priorities that we need. Supervision, engagement with visitors, ongoing training, and prioritize those things. I always talk about school safety is like eating an elephant. You have to just do it a bite at a time. You can't be overwhelmed and go, this is too much. I can't do anything. I can't do it all. So I'm going to do nothing. Instead, you have to prioritize, because anything you do as a new principal or an existing principal, anything you do to make your school just that much safer is better than what you did the day before. So I think it's the commitment to this is the way that I view this work. This is part of my professional practice, and we are always going to have that be something that is at the forefront, and we're just going to chip away at it. And I think that's really critical to not become overwhelmed, but to just prioritize.
So yeah, and I would add to that as for new principals to look at the discrepancy between you talk about reviewing policies and procedures, try to look at, is there a discrepancy between here's what we have written down, here's what we say we do, and here's what actually happens on a day-to-day basis, or here's what me as a school leader, I think is happening. But yet when I ask three different teachers, something totally different is happening. And I said I wasn't going to be an obnoxious attorney, but that is a huge potential for legal liability. That we have written down, our procedure says visitors must sign in at the office and they must show ID. Then that better be what you do. You either need to conform your behavior to your policy or conform your policy to your behavior, but you cannot have a discrepancy between those two.
I also wanted to address the other question that someone posed about how do you empower your staff, your faculty, and your students. I think it's really important to have, the big word is ongoing. Ongoing conversations, ongoing training, coming from an education, not just a law enforcement viewpoint. And I can't emphasize that enough. It is not appropriate or effective to do tactical training with third graders and with parents and with teachers. It is effective to have conversations that are developmentally appropriate, that come from an education viewpoint of here's what you can do, here's what's helpful, here's what's not helpful. And providing that training, and most significantly, with the rationale behind it. Not just do it because we said so. But here's why that's important. Here's why we ask you as parents to do this thing. Here's why we need you as students to do this thing. The rationale behind it is really critical for that empowerment that you're seeking. That really is going to be, that empowerment is going to be the key to a safer school.